The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Stocks taking a breather after a huge run. Economists talking out of both sides of their mouths again. Circular financing and vendor financing is all the rage. And our guest today is Andrew Wilkinson, Director of Trading Education at Interactive Brokers. All this and much more on episode number 940 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, it's Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It is the end of, just about, the end of September 2025, and we had a pretty good run in stocks, taking a little bit of a breather last week on a few days. Nothing major, but there was definitely some profit-taking being had, and this is one of those times of the year when we look at that seasonality where there's oftentimes more selling than buying. And I know, of course, you have to have a seller, a buyer, it has to equal. I'm talking about the concept of that there is more selling activity. Downdrafts in the market September and October are two of the months that have some of the greatest historical volatility and probably some of the worst overall returns if you take the totality of all that. So we're entering into October. Is everybody freaking out? No, not really. There's a lot of good tailwinds, not headwinds yet. We'll get to the headwinds in a second. There's a lot of good tailwinds that are still there, the opportunity for the continuation of earnings that are doing very well. Estimates are somewhere in the 9 to 10% next quarterly earnings. We're seeing that, generally speaking, that the economy is doing okay. Last week's numbers of 218,000 on the employment for the initial claims was pretty good. And that was actually a surprise. They thought was that the near-term situation with employment was getting a lot worse, especially after we saw those big revisions. We saw some economists talking about how inflation is kicking up and the employment situation is starting to get a little bit softer. And that, of course, if you take that and it really expand that to its fullest potential, that's what stagflation is all about. Are we at that yet? It takes a pretty special situation to create true stagflation. Are we there where we have inflation and an incredibly significant situation brewing in the jobs market? I don't think so. But it's more there than it has been. That's, I think, what we could say. The tendency to have a potential stagflation is much more heightened right now than it has been in a very long, 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 long time. So with that, we have to start thinking about markets and how they react and why it is that when we saw the interest rate reduction by the Fed, mortgage rates went up, long bonds rates went up, and overall the total yield curve moved a bit higher. And that's something we're going to talk about a lot over the next few weeks, I think, with some of our guests, particularly with Barry Eichengreen, who's coming on next week, professor over at UC Berkeley. He has some very interesting commentary and writings and papers about what's going on with the dollar and what's happening with interest rates. And I think we'll really dig down and talk about it with him in a significant manner. Today, before we get to our guest, I want to talk about this phenomena that's going on. What have we seen over the last few weeks? We saw things like Oracle and OpenAI and Microsoft and even Tesla X to a degree. And we've seen NVIDIA and Intel. Now, what do all these companies have in common? All of them have been part of this vendor financing and circular financing that I've been seeing that is very concerning. And let's talk about what some of this is, because both of these things can be structured in ways that essentially inflate the appearance of revenues, activity, and even I'll go so far as saying the financial health of a company. This can happen even when underlying fundamentals are weak. So let's start with some definitions and talk a little bit about what this is, because I think it's something we need to be aware of. Because when we look at circular financing, and in some cases, what is this? Money moving in loops between related entities. For example, we have Company A. You can stick whatever name you want on that, that lends money to Company B. We have Company A that buys into, uses equity or cash to buy into equity of another company. Or maybe even just infuses money very simply to get back an ownership amount, and that is then questioned. Then Company C pays Company A for services or equity. So you see how the circularity of this is going on, right? We have A lends money to Company B. B uses the funds to buy maybe Company C. Company C then buys or pays Company A for service or equity. And what just happened, right? It was just like, hi, Bob, here's $100. Thank you. Give it to Joe. Joe gets it. Thank you. Joe gives it back to me. I just made $100 somehow. I mean, that's as simplistic of a case you can get in this whole idea of circular financing. And it can create this illusion of revenue, of investment, of growth. And it's essentially just recycling capital without generating any real economic value. It can actually, I think, mislead a lot of investors. It's like eating your own arm and trying to believe that long-term sustainability of your diet is intact and you're not doing any damage, that is actually something that is nutritious. This is what we're seeing with some of the announcements this week. Companies, again, like Intel and Tesla, XAI, where they're going to, you know, Musk is talking about putting the companies together, and maybe there's going to be an infusion from Tesla into XAI, and maybe SpaceX will come together. All these different things we're seeing. Now, we have to add that to this next part, because I think when we take both of these, both the circular financing and vendor financing, there's where our problem is. So it's something we need to really look at. And now we have to take a moment and say, well, what's vendor financing? This is when a company basically sells its products to a company, but finances the product and purchases or whatever the service is by themselves. So the sale is booked as revenue, even though the cash hasn't been received potentially, or it is part of another deal with equity or debt. So, okay, haven't we heard a lot about that this week too? Haven't we heard about things like, historically we heard that Microsoft was saying, okay, we're going to give money to this company, but that company is going to actually buy cloud services for us, and they're going to guarantee over the next 5 years X amount of money. So what happened there? We talked about this 100 times in the past, the idea of utilizing your balance sheet assets and somehow converting them into the income statement. That is what has gone on for a while now. How long is that sustainable? Only as long as the companies that you actually infuse the money to become profitable. If they don't, that's that. And you're going to see a significant tail off of earnings. Now, the problem he has, again, is if you're your customer that you utilize for this, right? So if I lend money to Bob, and Bob then says, you know, I'm going to use that money to buy services from you. And the hope is that over time, the money that I give you is enough to help you build that business so that you continue utilizing my services. But what happens if that other company defaults? What if Bob defaults? If Bob defaults, the whole thing is off. What this does is has the ability to inflate the top line revenues. And that's what we've been seeing pretty substantially on top of the inflation numbers that we're seeing. And that makes the business look stronger than it really is. And if it's done aggressively, without proper risk controls, it could lead to balance sheet stress, regulatory scrutiny. But here we are in an environment where it's been going on for years, particularly in the tech space. Not something new. But the announcement by OpenAI this week, in the last couple of weeks, with hundreds of billions of dollars and promises over the next few years, with them having massive losses predicted over that time, it's like, what are you, what? How? What is that happening? Makes you kind of wonder. So why does this all matter? My concern is that a lot of investors are being misled by inflated revenues and growth figures. How do you know? How do you actually know? Well, we don't know until a few years from now, when some of the companies that were given money to generate back to the providing company are no longer able to sustain the buying patterns that they have. Therefore, the revenues will drop. Now, you also have the concern that some regulators, right? In the regulatory environment that we have now, really? Okay, but maybe some regulators may flag these practices if they are really obscuring the true picture. I mean, you may see that with auditors too. So what is actually happening is that some companies are propping up others through some pretty fancy financial engineering. Again, nothing new here, except they're helping other companies help themselves back. And in my opinion, with the lax regulatory oversight that we have now, it's only going to get worse. Nobody gets in trouble for any of this. It's only the suckers that fall for all this nonsense. And I think the Oracle deal that we saw, well, the Oracle announcements that we saw over the last several weeks has a lot of people very concerned. They missed earnings. Their outlook, on the other hand, was spectacular because they utilized that infusion of OpenAI. It was incredible. Incredible promises over the next 5 years or so in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And that's how much space they would utilize. But is that really going to happen? What if OpenAI says, you know what? We don't have that much need. Now, they could also say, let's go to the other side. You could be like, Andrew, but wait, why not be more positive? Who knows? Maybe they have a much greater need. But the build-outs that they are doing on the hopes that build it and they will come, and that the idea that the advanced AI, not the AI that we have now, the advanced AI, the inference, the next level of real thinking, of real decision making, that will help industry and create profitability for that industry. Whereas they'll keep on pouring money into the various companies that are the players in this industry. And NVIDIA pushed money into Intel, $5 billion. We saw that. In the hopes that they're going to be a partnership, they're going to build, they're going to do. NVIDIA is funding all these other places as well with some of the money that's being funded. So we have a domino effect. If any of these situations don't come to fruition and the funding company is finding out that they're not doing as well with this strategy and they pull back a little, could you imagine because of I don't want to call it leverage, but the magnitude of the money that's being used and how it is being stacked upon by company after company after company and thought about, boy, could that be problematic? Now, am I blowing the alarm here? I'm not exactly sure yet. It's very difficult to discern whether or not this is something that we really need to be concerned about to a point that we're like, okay, short the industry, we're out, this AI thing is going to explode. There is and are a lot of similarities between this and what happened with the internet and the companies that we know of that didn't last. The companies that weren't supposed to last that somehow figured it out, a la Amazon, right? Amazon was one of those companies. Amazon was like, how is a bookseller going to make it in this world? Or maybe even something like a Netflix. Very different, but yet pivoted. Amazon with their AWS, that's where the real money came in for a very long period of time to help them build the rest of their infrastructure. Netflix pivoted from a red labeled disc mailing and returning service into a full studio, a streaming studio. In a real life studio. So the pivots and what's gone on and the changes for those companies that weren't supposed to be around, right, that were supposed to fail to be the powerhouse they are today. But there are a lot of companies that we could probably go through as well that just aren't even around anymore. Lycos, remember them? Peapod. Webvan, AltaVista. We can go through a lot of names that you may or may not remember. The original social media MySpace, maybe still here, but not what it was. Didn't reach its potential, whatever that was. This is what happens during these kinds of major events in life where we see an industry bloom, grow, get established. There's winners and there's losers. But in this case, I find it to almost be, to a degree, just bear with me, to a degree, similar to the multiple mortgages that we saw on housing back in 2008, where it just took a little problem, the tide to go out slightly, for things to get messy. We're not going to see that as quickly here, because a lot of funds to mask all the problems. And if interest rates come down, it's better and it's good and will continue to do so. Interest rates go up, on the other hand, money becomes tight, a slowdown in any of these factors happen. That's what we have to be aware of. Right now, again, I'm really not there yet, but we're on alert. We're watching. We're being careful. Something to think about. Let's get to our guest. And our guest today is Andrew Wilkinson, and he's the Director of Trading Education at Interactive Brokers. He joined Interactive Brokers back in 2007, way back when. As a matter of fact, that's about the time this podcast started. His background, he had a background in interest rate and derivative trading in the city of London during the 90s, and he joined the brokers of Interactive Brokers to create market commentary about stocks, options, Forex, and bonds for the website before helping create the IBKR campus, which covers Traders Insights, Traders Academy, webinars, podcasts, and a variety of other financial training for all investors at all levels. Now, what's interesting is that we've talked about this before, but I wanted to really get to the horse's mouth this time about who really is working this, creating it, and what things are available. So, Andrew, welcome aboard. First time on The Disciplined Investor. Thanks for coming.
Lovely. Thank you very much for having me, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about, I think, you know, what I want. Can I start with something? Can I start with some of the highlights of things that are really cool happening at Interactive Brokers? Sure. So you've seen huge number of, well, I'm going to use the word darts. You know what that means. But for everybody else, you've seen a big number in transaction growth of last year, huh?
Yeah, I think our darts are up in August about 29% year on year. Darts daily average revenue trades at about 3.488 million transactions. These are big numbers, but Andrew, it speaks testimony to the type of client that Interactive Brokers attracts. You know, people who trade professionally for a living. And they are active. They embrace volatility. They love the options market. And of course, those 0 days to expiration options have become extremely popular. So we've done very, very well out of that. I think AUM nowadays is over 700 billion, 713.2 billion, which again is up more than by precisely a third over a year ago. Actually, sorry, it's 38% higher. And then the number of customers. You mentioned earlier that I started here in 2007, just before the IPO, and we had, I think, 89,000 clients. Today, fast forward 18 years, we're up to 4 million client accounts. That's 32% higher than a year ago. So just a lot of trading going on, a lot of in and out of volatile markets and different asset classes around the world.
You know, I think that we started not too far after using Interactive Brokers for our clients, something about 2010. So we were, I guess, one of the first, not the first, but we were, you know, in the growth phase, in the beginnings of the growth phase, because, you know, back then, even back then, you know, we're talking a lifetime of technology, right? Since now to back then. Back then, you still had great technology.
Yeah.
Which is what were the drawing features of that. So that's pretty cool. You know, you recently joined the S&P 500 back in August, which congratulations to that, by the way. That's awesome. What drew you personally to a career in the area of trading and specifically financial education?
Well, It followed a career of trading, which I really embraced back in London. I think I started trading in 1989 on the Sterling desk at Fuji Bank back in London. And I just couldn't get enough of markets, particularly the futures markets. And then as I progressed, I came over to America to go to business school. And I was just heavily involved in writing and writing specifically about financial markets. And then out of the blue, Interactive Brokers approached me in 2006, said, come up for an interview. I was down in Florida at the time, came up to Greenwich. And I just really enjoyed explaining how markets work. I'm kind of a mentor to any investor who wants to understand all about trading. And I think we've done a very, very good job. I've built up a great team here to help create videos and podcasts and conduct webinars and so on. So it's all about, you know, providing something for nothing for people to help them understand, because we want good traders. Yeah, we want people to last so that our customer base not only expands, but becomes more wealthier.
It's a partnership. It's a bottom line. It's a good for everybody, right? And the funny thing is, I know a lot of, well, when I say a lot, you know stories, right? And they just want to get people in with $2,000 to trade. And most people that don't get training, what do they end up doing? They blow up. You know, the $2,000, the $5,000, they get sucked in. You know, they get some kind of two-bit crazy theories on a few trades. They get hooked and then they kind of get in over their skis and then they blow up. And that's not good. That's not good for you.
No, we've, you know, something I was taught when I joined this company is that people eventually hear about Interactive Brokers because of the low prices. They become good at trading stocks and then they decide, wow, we were paying too much in commission. This is going back when there were commissions. And that's exactly what we want. People who are going to become active traders to benefit from the strength in technology, the low prices, and that global access to markets. So you can trade pretty much anywhere around the world with the Interactive Brokers platform.
So you're kind of at the, you're in the boot camp and in the training, but also post that where people have success and they come back to, let's call it initial training education to mentorship, right? That whole range is where you cover. Now, here's my question. What are some of the most common gaps? The things that investors, you know, have this area of knowledge that just they need filled, right? And what do they come at you with maybe in the early stages? Let's break this up into two parts. The early stages of when they come to you, this gap they have in terms of their understanding of investing. And then kind of later on, there's probably some gaps as well. So can you cover both of those and how you really address those as a financial trainer?
That's a really good question, Andrew. The real hole in anyone's education is options, I think. As I said earlier, people used to come to Interactive Brokers realizing that commissions were lower and that they were doing something more actively and in terms of trading stocks. Once they understand the stock market, how prices move, not just up but also down, they start to learn about volatility. And when they learn about volatility, they realize that there's something very, very clinical that can be used to lever positions and to take advantage of market movements and to also hedge and speculate. And that is the world of options. And options are not easy unless you're actually trading them day in, day out to try and understand what will the price of an option be in the event that this stock price goes where I believe it's going to go. And if I'm long of a stock, you know, how am I going to protect myself in the event that there is some news event that drives the market down or the stock that I'm holding down. So we've gone to special efforts over the years. And I know the industry has done this too, but we've gone to great efforts to talk about options. That's kind of bread and butter for a lot of our traders here. Something that we've done more recently, you know, having made many, many videos and we've had webinar guests from the industry and from the exchanges come in and talk about options education. We recently built a new interactive options trading tool, which is free at the IBKR campus. Mm-hmm. And it allows people to interact with the screen, and it's going to It's going to take you through options fundamentals. It'll help you solve real problems. The interface allows you to, you know, drag words into sentences to help you understand the definition of a call, the definition of a put, and other related things. It's going to teach you the basics about calls and puts, but it also walks you through at your own pace to advanced strategies. So we started off with an introduction to options, an introduction to Greeks, and then we moved into basic call buying, where the break even, and so on, and then moved on to vertical spreads. And there's even a challenge mode, which I think is really, really cool for somebody who's sitting, for example, the Series 7 exams, where you just, you know, if you're not in that market every day trading options, learning about them on paper is hard. So the ability to actually drag the tools across the screen to help you understand where a break even is, what the premium of an option is, why the strike price is important. This tool is really, really cool. We've even created this challenge mode, which allows you to say, I need to strengthen my understanding of specific spreads so that I can understand how break evens work, because I've got a test coming up soon for Series 7. So that's kind of the biggest area of the biggest challenge, I'd say, in creating education.
In terms of, I get that, you know, and options are challenging, and in the world of, and this is what I know, tell me what you think. In the world of investing, they say the smartest of all smart people trade bonds, right? That's what they say. At the bond market, generally speaking, I should say that, right? But clearly, in my opinion, you know, it's one thing to buy a stock based on fundamentals or a chart, sell short. It's another thing entirely to not only look at the options market, because the options market takes all of that, adds a ton of different other items, Black-Scholes calculations, and as you mentioned, volatility and the Greeks, but it also then turns it upside down backwards, where you can kind of sell, you can be on both sides, or utilize a combination of it to create some kind of, we'll call it spread trade of sorts. That gets complicated.
It does, but as I say, once you understand it, you really understand it. The analogy I would make is like learning a language. You're only going to really understand that language, like French, if you go and spend time in Paris or anywhere in France and speak it to people. You've got to be in the thick of it. Same with options. Looking at what options do in terms of allowing you to speculate on a market, you must understand what the Greeks are there for, how they all relate to the price of the underlying, and how to pick a strike price, how to pick the expiration date across time. But yeah, it's I think an options trader will probably outplace a bond trader, in my opinion. Yep. But if you can trade bond options too, that probably puts you king of the hill, doesn't it?
Like options on futures, let's get crazy now. I mean, talk about volatility. That's fun. The thing about of the options is also one of the things that I think people like about it today more than anything is they have a very first of all, it can be short term, it can be exciting, it can be exhilarating. I mean, I've had options. What we do for either personally for clients that I mean, zoom on the numbers are. Like, how much is it up today? You know, that kind of thing. And we know all the stories about like GameStop, for example, and how that guy, Roaring Kitty, played the GameStop market. Now, by the way, Reddit is all a flurry now with the idea of options and warrants once again on squeeze plays. It's starting to pop up again. Never really died off, but it's really starting to come up again. The thing about options, what's interesting is the training that you can get on, various places on IBKR campus and all that. You've actually decided that's kind of an open door for anybody, haven't you?
The options world, yeah.
No, to get the training, to get the IBKR campus
training,
yeah, and the education,
yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We as I said earlier, we believe that a good client is an educated client. That's probably the best way to put it. But yeah, you just make all of this available for free to the world, and you just keep telling people about it and allow them to find it. You send emails to clients and to non-clients and let them see if this is the quality of the work that we do for free on the campus. And when we tell you all about our low commissions and strength in technology, then there's got to be something behind it, right? So that's just, it's just simple business.
Well, you made it also approachable. That's the difference. There's a lot of training modules out there. There's a lot of ways to find things. I have platforms that I use in my business and not trading. So I'm not saying that. This is a separate and entirely, forget the whole trading, forget the brokerage. I'm talking about different platforms for management of client accounts or, and they have a lot of training and all. It is not approachable. It's like, I don't understand. Why is this not like the newest of first, or why can't I search this? Or I don't understand. But you've made it very, the thing that I think you've done very successfully is made it very approachable, very easy, and not cumbersome to deal with. That's, I think, a very, you know what it is? It reminds me of, do you remember, do you know why you do this? But why did Apple win the iPod race? The first iPod, the first MP3 music player, by the way, which I have one, I actually have the MP3 player that was the first one out in my drawer. Okay. It was the Diamond Rio, 64 megabyte. The problem was it did fine. And I'm sure if I charge that little bugger up right now, it'll light right up. Okay. Put a battery in it, will light right up. And God knows, actually, I should do that one day and see what songs are on there. But the problem was, there was no way to get the information on and off easily or to download. Of course, we had Napster and all that kind of stuff. Remember LimeWire, all these crazy things where we do this weird sharing of stuff to get the music. But trying to get that back and forth on, because there's only a certain amount, was very difficult. So the idea was great. Everybody loved the idea, but it was impossible until Apple iTunes came around, right? And they were able to create a platform to manage all this. And of course, they benefited. But, and then to have it easily exchange and update your iPod at the time. That's kind of what you did. You made this whole education thing really easy for people, approachable and accessible. So great job on that.
Thank you. And I think I used to speak to a lot of, we have a lot of contributors here at the campus. They either submit articles for daily posting, or we take podcasts and videos. We work with people to provide webinars, and then we have the Traders Academy, which is teaches people how to use any of our platforms. And the more I explained this to a potential contributor, the more the easier it seemed in my mind. So this is exactly how we need to show people, to showcase the platform, to explain to them how to trade a different asset class, what's behind it, why they should consider looking at it. So it became very kind of formulaic, I would say, particularly with the Traders Academy videos, because we it's a video, it has a script which doubles up as study notes, and then we have a quiz for it. So if you can fit into that mindset, then you're welcome to come to Interactive Brokers and be a contributor to do that. So everything just ultimately seemed to fit together. And if I do a webinar with a contributor, I offer them the opportunity to come in and do a podcast with me as well. So much content these days, and managing it is one of the challenges, but yeah. I've got a fantastic team around me who help with all of that.
Let's talk about something, two things. First, I want to talk about the idea of common mistakes, because I think that's really important. Because I always taken the view that if I can get rid of the negative part of the discussion, in other words, what could go wrong? If I could figure out what could go wrong, then there on the other side is just what can go right. So if I can delineate exactly what my downside is on anything or the negatives of something, and I can figure that out. And if I can't, well, then it's insurmountable and I can't either invest or make that decision or go that direction. But what's one of the most common, you've been doing this for years, so what's one of the most common mistakes you would see investors make, new investors making, and how can they avoid them?
I think it always comes back to risk management. What you just described there was risk minimization. If you're doing any kind of a process, then if you think about what could go wrong, you're minimizing the outlay, whatever it is you're doing. If it's, my dad used to be very good at planning holidays and, packing the trunk of the car perfectly. So if you do that, then you're not gonna like have to leave a child at home because the backseat has is accommodating a suitcase. So I think The biggest mistake people make is not planning the trade. They've become too eager to buy that company, shares in a particular company, without really thinking about where should I get in. So you should learn all about different, first of all, having some approach to a fundamental analysis, not just, the world is full of opportunities. So just because you missed the dip in NVIDIA to like $98, whatever it was last time it fell, and it's pretty much doubled since then. There's always going to be a chance to get back in at something. There's always, what's that expression? Life's a bowl of cherries, right? You're always going to get a second chance. And you mentioned also those meme stocks, right now continuing to squeeze as we're at all-time highs. We're not going to be at all-time market highs forever. There's always going to be a correction. So I think patience and having a plan for your trade, knowing where you want to get in, what objectively you want to do, what's your time frame? Are you trading this week or for a month? You think the stock price is going to go up $10? Think about that. Think about how you might want to augment the play using options. If you're able to sell a secured put in order to get into the trade, if the stock price comes down, and if it doesn't come down, you don't get assigned. Then you're going to keep the premium you made on writing the put. When are you going to start selling call options against that core position? How many shares do you need in order for you to be able to write a covered call against that position? Can you actually even do that? So knowing where you're going with the trade from the outset is always a good thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And then having a plan. I mean, I think it's the point you just made there, right? So that you don't have the whole family screaming, "Where's Kevin? Where's Kevin?" right? We left Kevin again. I hope that really hasn't happened in your family. It sounds like somebody could have been left behind if it wasn't for Dad. But nonetheless, the game plan, I think, is always important. I think as an investor, trading your own account, trading a stock, maybe not entirely trading your account, but playing that side. Oftentimes we look at, what's the great opportunity here, but don't want to really focus in on the downside, right?
Yeah. If you think about what could go wrong, I think it's also really important to understand the company that you're dealing with. I recently got involved in an IPO name. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know that much about it, but I was excited about the sector. And, I'm sitting on a loss at this point. Wish I'd done my research beforehand. The Interactive Brokers platform allows investors to look at fundamentals on any stocks. We have a new tool, a new research tool called Connections. And we are, part of that is the investment themes. So The Connections tool helps you to identify relationships between companies and economic indicators and then other financial instruments, so it can enhance your decision making. If I'd have looked more through the lens of the Connections tool, I might have come up with a different company that actually had earnings ahead of it, rather than, like many IPO names have potentially have losses for the first few years while they're out there. So I might have been able to find a better alternative in the same space. If you want to own retail shares in a Walmart or Kohl's or Ross or any of those names, are there other tools that you can use? What economic indicators should you be looking at? Something that's become quite popular these days, Andrews, is event contracts. And we launched this maybe a year, maybe 18 months ago. And it allows you to take one of those retail names, and the software will look at what economic data is available to potentially allow you to hedge. So keep an eye on economic indicators such as retail sales or maybe employment. If you decide that the retail sales might be slowing down, but you don't want to get rid of the stock, you might be able to take a yes or a no position on one of those economic indicators to help potentially hedge some of the decision making you've got in play there.
Good stuff. So for example, let's just kind of stay on this for one more second. You make a bad decision. So let's say, for example, one of those IPOs was, Figma, or maybe it was Circle. Who knows? Let's say you have one of those, right? So now what? So how do you now manage that position without, maybe you just get out, I don't know. Maybe you write some options on, I don't know. Maybe you buy in, maybe, I don't know. What do you do now that, let's kind of flush this out. You have a position that went against you. You're like, oh, I'm not sure, that, you know, I maybe could have done better research and all that. Fine, you do some more research now. What's the next steps?
I think part and parcel of what you need to do at the outset is set a financial stop. And I've seen this so many times where people, rather than, they'll say, I'll give it another day. I'll wait till this report's out. No, you should always just set a stop in advance. It just becomes very, very mechanical. You need to know where you're going to get out, how much you're going to afford to lose, and stick to it. Because as I said earlier, there's always an opportunity to get back in. You could also, in advance, look at which put options, if you're long of a stock, which put option, which expiration, which strike price to consider buying to help protect. You could also, again, make sure that you're educated well enough in the option space, because you could put on a less costly vertical spread, which might allow you to buy a put option and sell a put option at a different strike. So that's a vertical spread that is a less costly
insurance
combination.
Like insurance stock. Oh, to a point.
Yeah.
So let me ask you about this. Option strategy that I've used for many years. Whatever option that I'm going to get into, and let's say that's a call, just for the discussion here, I will look at the level that I want, where I think the stock is going, the time where I think it's going to get there, and no matter what I do, I always go at least a month out more, because it's always somehow never seems to make it on the date that I put it at. And I always got to go out a little bit further. And that seems to, I don't know why, that seems to work. There's nothing magical there, I'm just saying.
Well, stock markets tend to go up over time. You know, maybe you're just very good at timing the market there, Andrew, in terms of getting in. I mean, I always try and use a limit price. So I think, okay, the option's trading at a dollar now, but I'd really only rather pay 60 cents for this. So again, it's being patient. And if I miss the boat, I miss the boat. There's always another contract coming along later. Because options are vehicles that will erode over time if you're not right. The trick to getting it right with options is, you know, if it's not going right, then either take a loss or roll out to buy yourself some more time. And that will, rather than watching your option go from, you know, a dollar or 50 cents down to zero, you might still have some extrinsic value in there, which will allow you to roll into a different contract.
Yeah. Let me switch gears here. And let's ask a question that I'm seeing a little bit. Interest in the growth, I think, once again, in investment clubs. And I know that you guys do something with that in terms of collaborative investing, right?
Not so much, not that I'm aware of.
I know that I deal with it. It is, people have been coming to me and saying, hey, we're getting a bunch of friends together and they want to open an account so that they can kind of see the kind of trading we do and watch us and monitor us, probably steal some of the ideas we have, but that's fine. And then there's investment. I don't know. I just thought I saw something about that coming up. It's right. We can
Yes. I recently recorded a podcast in the UK with Jerry Perez, who's the CEO over there. I think there have been some rule changes in the United Kingdom surrounding investment clubs, who can do what and who can't do something. And I think a lot of the local brokers are potentially not permitting that kind of club anymore. They're getting rid of certain clients or making the rules harder. So I know Jerry was very keen to discuss that, because I think it's you know, we have the type of account that allows investment clubs to come on board. I wouldn't be surprised if it happens so much in the United States too. We have a friends and family type account. So this is kind of a precursor to becoming an advisor on the Interactive Brokers platform. If you have over X clients, I think it's 25 or maybe so many AUM, you have to ultimately become an advisor. But what you can do in the first place, you can look after friends and family's money because you're good at trading, and you can you know, if you have a personal account with us, and you could, or you can just come to Interactive Brokers and open up friends and family account, and what within the, you know, I think the money's segregated, so you have different accounts for everybody, and there's certain drop downs in the platform. And you know, hopefully you end up making money for your family, your friends, and for yourself.
Right, exactly. And there is that. I've seen that over the years, people use that. And, you know, they have, for one reason or the other, it makes it very easy.
Yeah.
I got to ask the question.
I think it also gives you time, as that investor on behalf of people, it gives you time to get your ducks in a row in order to create that, the framework for a financial advisor.
And I've known people that have done that. You know, they say, hey, look, I think I can trade. You know, you have five friends, you pick up, you know, $500,000 each or $250,000 or a million, whatever the number is, right? And they run that until they get to the point that they're required to register with the state or, you know, federal, depending on where they are, and, you know, formalize the actual advisory relationship.
Yeah.
So that's something.
I'm always astounded. You know, you go out for dinner with some friends and they're not in financial services, but they tend to know a ton about a specific, you know, they've got a hobby and they don't know how to invest, but they know an awful lot about that sector. And it's people like that you have conversations with, and you're going, yeah, well, you know what? My friend's a good trader, and you might want to consider investing with him and sharing some of your knowledge.
Yep, exactly. Let's talk about a big thing we haven't even touched on. We haven't even gotten anywhere near. And it's the idea of advanced data analytics and AI, which I know that you are building things are, but particularly how you are using that. Not necessarily the broad brush Interactive Brokers. I'm talking about training and how you're leveraging some of that to help with the training curve.
Yeah, so several people on my team do use AI. We you know, it's sometimes easier to write a script for a new narrative on a particular sector, or even in-house we have you know, we have the ability to use iBot, as we call it, to bring in information about all of our trading platforms and everything that we're hooked into in order to create a well curated synthesis about the tool that will serve the customer well. And we can create infographics on top of scripts, as well as for our glossary. We can come up with good definitions of terms that don't plagiarize from the internet. So there's plenty of ways of doing that. I think this connections, the integrated research tool I mentioned earlier, you know, that's strongly driven with AI in order to help investors analyze connected instruments and strategies in a single view. So it's moving at quite a pace here.
The other thing that's interesting is, well, for advisors, you have the AI, I know that is the review of a portfolio, which is cool. But also you have things that for individuals, well, I guess advisors could use it too, but let's talk about individuals, like portfolio analyst. As an example. Now, there's nothing quite like having an understanding, unbiased, okay, understanding of exactly what's going on in your portfolio. And I think there is some things inside of portfolio analyst that can give you a little bit of an awakening and kind of a nudge into maybe some things that are going on in your portfolio, right? And how they connect with each other, how they work together. But tell me more about that, because I think that's a really cool thing that gets underplayed.
Yeah, we've come up with several tools this year to help people with taxes, with budgeting, and with retirement that allow them to take a big overview of what's happening in their portfolio. It allows them to you know, bring in a partner's income in order to track investment incomes across all accounts throughout the year. So that, you know, the tax planner allows you to create a tax profile and then configure values, and it will help you estimate year-end taxes. So there's no surprises at the end of the year. You're able to view realized and unrealized gains and losses, for example, and dividends and the interest that you collected on each account. So you can see very, very clinically what your obligations to the IRS will be. Something that I'm not fantastic at home is budgeting. You know, you're now able to track and categorize spending to help budget more effectively. And
but you have plugins there. It's not like you just have to enter everything on your own. What do you have? Like, I think a Plaid plugin integration to bring in your other accounts, right?
That's right. That's right. You can connect to your bank accounts. You can connect to other brokerage accounts. You can even put in a value for, you know, you can put in your home address in Zillow, and it will tell you the estimated worth of the house. And then you can also connect to your mortgage lender's account, so that it will look at both the asset value and the liability incurred on it. So you get an overall sense of your of your net worth. So there's plenty of things that the portfolio analyst will do. We've also created a retirement outlook in the portfolio analyst too, and it looks at your current assets, expenses, and then the projected asset growth, and again consolidates all that information from interactive brokers, external brokers, and bank accounts, and all of your other assets, including real estates, and allow you to incorporate your retirement preferences in terms of when you might be thinking about retiring. It'll allow you to do some scenario analysis so that you can say, well, I'm going to, what if I retired at 65 or change that to 68? And what if I have, you know, I'll allow for $1,000 from working at, you know, working at Walmart when I retire as a greeter or whatever. So any future employment expectations is what I'm saying, and then your monthly expenses and more. So this is a really cool tool, and we've done videos for all of these items in across the campus in Traders Academy. So many different kind of ways of extending the personal finance aspect for our clients.
You know, it's interesting because all these things can be used by the client, but then pushed up to the advisor. So I have a thought on this. So while everybody can learn to trade and may do so well, where you can learn to understand more about your retirement and the internal workings of your portfolio and all these different things put together, the fact is that sometimes it's a matter of perspective. I always tell people, you know, why is it that some people should have an advisor? And I say, well, it's like this. You know, I can cut my hair. I can use a scissor. I can kind of just put it between my fingers, grow to the hair, snip, 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 and I'm cutting hair, right? I'm functionally cutting hair. However, when it comes to the back of my head, I can't see it so well. Now, I can put some mirrors there and hopefully go upside down and backwards in my thinking and cut. But it's a matter of perspective. Why do I use a hairstylist? Why do I use a barber? Because it's a matter of perspective. And sometimes while these tools give a lot of information, I still think that there's something to be said about bringing in your advisor to work with you on that output to put it all together. What say you on that?
I couldn't agree more. There's things that I don't know about financial markets. This thing, I've just put my twin daughters into college up in New York and Massachusetts, and I wasn't nearly well enough educated on college spending, loans, and planning, and all the rest of it. So I'm just kind of winging that at this point. And it's the sort of thing that an advisor will do for you. It'll make you realize that you have certain life events that you need to be prepared for or be putting money aside for, particularly when it comes to retirement. You know, this is student debt is probably going to add to my career.
Yeah.
and defer my retirement at this point. So the services of an advisor are probably, you know, very useful, particularly when it comes to, I'd say, as you mature, you get older, and you don't realize that you probably need to tone down the risk appetite that you have. You shouldn't be investing all of your money in IPO names or very risky tech stocks. And that you should be looking for potentially more cash flow from dividends and that kind of things. And I'm like, yeah, we can all go away and do that research. But if you don't have time for it, or you just don't feel comfortable enough doing that, I'd say that's really where the advisor comes in.
Yeah, good stuff. Andrew Wilkerson, IBKR Interactive Brokers, Director of Trading Education, and doing a great job at it. Thanks for joining me. First time on the show. I appreciate it.
That's brilliant. I'm really delighted to be here, Andrew. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
We'll talk soon. Thanks.
All right. Bye for now.
That's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Entering into October, some spooky times. We got, well, Halloween, of course. But nonetheless, we have some great other guests coming on, some great education. We'll continue talking about this vendor financing issue, this circular financing. And I think a lot of this you can get to know when you start watching the news and seeing some of the things that are talked about. And when they talk about multiple companies putting money into others, start putting your antennas up a little bit to understand, well, what does that actually mean? And a lot of the education you get in this area is, of course, that was just talked about with our guest, Andrew. Andrew W. I'm Andrew H. So thanks for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.